The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This brief points to the fact that they're going to just try to create, for lack of a better term, reasonable doubt, although I think in the Senate it's more like any fig leaf they can grab, to undermine one or more elements here. And then they build the case why that should discount the impeachment. They do it on page 12 when they argue that by charging multiple alleged wrongs in one article, the House of Representatives has made it impossible to guarantee compliance with the constitutional mandate.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 3rd, 2021. We got an impeachment trial coming next week. And the two sides, the impeachment managers for the House of Representatives and the lawyers for the president, the former president, that is, of the United States, filed their briefs before the Senate today. They couldn't be more different. One is long, legally dense, and factually rich. The other is short, a mere 14 pages, and contains a bunch of interesting oddities. Joining me in the virtual jungle studio to chew over the briefs are Quinta Jurecic, Lawfare's managing editor, and David Priest, Lawfare's chief operating officer. We talked about what the two sides are arguing and what it says about the cases they mean to present to the Senate. We talked about why the president's brief contains errors, which won't surprise a whole lot of people. And we talked about whether there are going to be witnesses next week when the two sides have to present their cases before the senators themselves. It's the Lawfare Podcast, February 3rd, impeachment briefing. All right, David, get us started. What was filed today, and were there any surprises about it?
You know, it's really a tale of two briefs, which some could say would take us back to the Bill Clinton impeachment, but let's not go there. You've got two different documents here that could not be farther apart. Yes, they both contain words like Donald Trump, president, high crimes and misdemeanors, but otherwise they're virtually in different universes. So the first one is the trial memorandum of the House of Representatives in the impeachment trial. And it is signed by the House of Representatives impeachment managers, led by Jamie Raskin of Maryland. And it is somewhere around 70 to 80 pages of evidence, logic, argumentation, extensive footnotes and endnotes. I believe the footnotes contain four references to Lawfare. So that's definitely in the right direction.
So they're clearly right.
At least in those four instances, perhaps, yeah. Yes. This briefing has a brief introduction, which has some pretty strong language, but I would argue generally compellingly written. It has a statement of facts that goes for some 31 pages, and then it develops the argumentation, laying out that President Trump did commit high crimes and misdemeanors, that there is no defense for his conduct along the likely lines that we will see, having to do with everything from free speech to that the election results were different than they actually were. And then it concludes And in doing so, it anticipates the arguments of the president's legal team, such that it is, and pretty convincingly dismantles them. Now, on the other side, we have the answer from the Trump rump legal team, which is frankly something I say on Twitter too often because now it really deserves it. How embarrassing. It's the kind of thing that when I used to grade papers in college classes, I probably would have lowered it because of the errors. Its format is bad. There's actually inconsistent spacing between items. There is one clear typo on it when something that's, I believe, singular should be plural or vice versa. And it makes many blanket assertions without evidence or argument to back them up. Simple claims that are thrown out there as bald assertions. These, in theory, are to present the basis for the arguments in the Senate for the upcoming trial. If, in fact, the president's legal team relies on these arguments and solely these arguments, it looks like it will be a very short trial because they won't have much to say to most of the claims of the House impeachment managers.
Quintel, what were your reactions to the two documents?
Pretty much in line with David's, I have to say. When the response brief came out maybe an hour or so after the House's brief, there was some discussion in the virtual office about what the font size was. And I joked that the real question was what the font size of the periods was. If anyone remembers the old trick in college where you're running out of time on a paper, so you crank the font size on the periods up to, you know, 20 point font to try to meet the length. That's kind of the energy that I'm getting from this document. As David says, it's oddly formatted. It's set up as dividing the article of impeachment into averments and responding to those averments, which has this sort of weird result that a lot of the 14 pages of this brief is actually just quotes from the articles of impeachment themselves. So the new text is actually even shorter than that. And it's not framed like a reply brief. It's framed, as one appellate lawyer suggested to me on Twitter, sort of framed like an answer to a motion or an answer to a complaint. It's very odd, and I'm genuinely not sure what to make of it. And that's before we get to the aspects of just, you know, the formatting being strange and hard to read, and which is in line with past Trump legal efforts. If anyone recalls Trump lawyer John Dowd's penchant for sending out emails in Comic Sans font. It's just worded weirdly. It refers to Trump throughout as the 45th president, which I wonder if
45th is a synonym for former.
Right, exactly. So because Trump refuses to admit that he lost the election, he can't say that he's the former president. So he's stuck with this weird locution of 45th president. And so at one point, for example, you end up with this incredibly odd statement where the brief states, insufficient evidence exists upon which a reasonable jurist could conclude that the 45th president's statements were accurate or not, and he therefore denies they were false. And I think that tangle of language is really representative of the strangeness of this document and its willingness to kind of use very, very odd locutions and very odd formatting to cover up the fact that Trump really has very little to say as a matter of legal argument.
All right. So let's talk about it from a strategic point of view. A document, granted they are in different universes, but they do reflect arguments that are going to have to be made in the same trial. So what does each of these documents tell us about the case that the respective sides that filed them are intending to make starting next week? David, get us started with the House manager's side. What do you see as the trial strategy reflected in that document?
Yeah, the document, if it is followed in the trial itself, will lay out a rather logical sequential series of events. laying out that President Trump refused to accept the results of the election before the election itself, and then went on this long series of tweets, of speeches, of other comments to cast doubt upon the election results and undermine confidence in the election. And increasingly, as the document highlights in bold text, use language that implies violence or could reasonably be interpreted as a call to action. In doing so, the argument develops that this is a violation of the oath of office, and it highlights exactly where and how. It talks about the democratic process itself being attacked, and that being a high crime and misdemeanor. It talks about the imperilment of Congress as an institution directly from the executive branch in the person of the president. And then I find, interestingly, it also adds an element of high crimes and misdemeanors that President Trump undermined national security. And it lays this out in what it says are three different ways that, on top of the things that we have all seen and done, that this is an even bigger threat to national security. One is that the mob that stormed the Capitol had access to and stole sensitive materials and electronics. And this required a thorough security review to determine the extent of the breach. Number two, they said it was a national security threat because it has emboldened other violent extremists. And although they didn't include it, they could include the recent DHS terrorism bulletin talking about domestic violent extremism for the first time as a warning going out to the public. And then third, they say it's a national security threat because President Trump's conduct tarnished the reputation of the United States abroad and is a propaganda bonanza for America's adversaries. It's an interesting section because it's not necessary for the other claims, that is, to point out that he violated his oath of office, attacked the democratic process, and imperiled Congress, and as such committed high crimes and misdemeanors. But it's pointing out, particularly to some Senate Republicans, I believe, this is the exact kind of thing you often talk about. You talk about these elements of national security, and we're going to put it in your face that these things actually were a threat to those elements of national security. Finally, I will point to just some of the language that jumped out to me, and then I'll pause there as we go through this. I liked the phrase in the introduction that the House impeachment managers used. They highlight some of this behavior and then say, presidents do not get a free pass to commit high crimes and misdemeanors near the end of their term. Allowing presidents to subvert elections without consequence would encourage the most dangerous of abuses. This clearly an attempt to preempt the argument that because the president is no longer in office, that the impeachment and the trial for the impeachment are moot, which is, of course, one of the main arguments in the very short presidential brief.
All right, Quinto, what do you read as the trial strategy for the impeachment managers based on this brief?
I think David and I are pretty much in agreement. I will say to start off that I thought that the section on national security was the weakest part of the brief, which overall I feel is pretty strong. I think it makes sense to me for strategic reasons, for the same reasons that David laid out. On the other hand, I think that there's more than a whiff to my mind of sort of national security often means important. And so there's a tendency to kind of backfill something that's important as therefore relevant to national security, or that its relevance to national security is the reason why it's important. I have to say that I think the president, you know, making America look weak abroad or degrading American influence is not really the main reason why he should be impeached here, right? The main reason is that he tried to overthrow an election. That said, look, it is part D in a long list of reasons why his conduct was impeachable, but it did jump out at me. What really struck me reading through this brief is how committed it is to telling a story. There's a very tight, taut narrative that really carries through. It sort of walks through Trump's actions immediately after the election, attempting to strong arm various state and local election officials toward the run up to January 6th. And then when it gets to January 6th, it sort of speeds up and takes you inside the riot and inside the Capitol and includes a lot of details of, you know, members of Congress fearing for their lives. I noted that it includes, not by name, but a story from Jamie Raskin, Representative Jamie Raskin, who's one of the impeachment managers who told his chief of staff to protect his family. And the chief of staff then stood at the door with a makeshift weapon. That jumped out at me because given that Raskin is one of the impeachment managers, I think we might well expect him to tell that story on the floor. And I think that it's useful is a weird word in this context, but useful in a way for the impeachment case that, as I think a named senator said to a reporter shortly after the riot, the senators, the judges in the trial are themselves witnesses, right? This happened to them. The emotions are very, very fresh. I mean, I think it was striking to me that we're, you know, this brief came out with this sort of very tense, emotionally laden description of the Capitol riot the morning after Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez streamed an Instagram live video that got a lot of commentary describing how she thought at one point during the riot that she was going to be killed by a rioter. So I think that the brief does a really good job pulling on that emotional thread. That said, look, I don't want to shortchange the legal reasoning. I think that there's a lot there and they did a very nice job addressing it sort of succinctly. But insofar as this trial, presumably like the last trial, is going to be less legal reasoning and more, you know, tugging at the heartstrings, it seems like the House has a pretty good case. And there may be a sense in which, you know, the case is easier to make than it was in the Ukraine impeachment, because whereas the costs to Trump's conduct in the Ukraine case were abroad, the costs of this case are right at home, and the senators know exactly what happened as a result of Trump's conduct. So it will be interesting to see how that bears out.
Two thoughts to follow up on that, Ben. One on the substance of the brief here, and then one on the two different sides that they hit. On the substance, it's interesting that a large chunk of this is devoted to the jurisdictional issue. That is the idea that the Senate does not have jurisdiction to try this impeachment at all. And I certainly like the fact that they begin that with the quote from John Quincy Adams, who as a former president said that he held himself, so long as I have the breath of life in my body, amenable to impeachment by the House for everything I did during the time I held any public office. And then, of course, they go on to talk about the Belknap case and the Archibald case and others that Lawfare listeners and readers are probably familiar with after the last few weeks. But it's a long section that goes back into British and state practices regarding late impeachments. On the two sides argument, the one thing that Quinta and I focused on in talking about the brief so far are the elements of the brief that talk about what the president did, what his actions were before the election, after the election, and then on January 6th itself, and then also some presidential actions that took place after the event at the Capitol. But the impeachment managers do not stop there. They actually do pay attention to what the president did not do, which they summarize in the introduction as dereliction of duty. But they write somewhere in the middle of the document that not only did President Trump fail to issue unequivocal statements ordering the insurrectionists to leave the Capitol, he also failed in his duties as commander-in-chief by not immediately taking action to protect Congress and the Capitol. And I think that's going to be an emotional moment in the trial where the impeachment managers can look at the assembled senators who cannot talk back and point out that this president left them in the hands of the mob and he did not do his constitutional duty to protect the Constitution and the constitutional order, but also their physical persons during the attack on the Capitol.
Yeah, and just to remind people that the oath actually, you know, has language to this effect, right? The presidential oath is not neutral on the question of the president's duty to act in the face of a rebellion. It actually does require that he will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, defend the Constitution of the United States. Legit question that I just to foot stomp David's point, whether a president who is laughing and enjoying a riot where the Capitol is stormed can be said to have been honoring that oath at that moment. All right, there's one additional aspect of this brief that I want to ask you both about, which is I read it with particular attention to the question of whether it suggests that the managers are planning to call witnesses, or whether we should read it as them being willing to argue this case on the public record as it currently exists. And the key period of time, I think, for purposes of this question is the period after the president makes the speech, when the riot is going on, what is he doing? They are, in the brief, relying entirely on press reports for that purpose, the purpose of fleshing this out. Quinta, do you think that suggests that Raskin and company are planning to, you know, call everybody around the president, including the senators that he telephoned, and try to get them to flesh this out, something that Lindsey Graham specifically warned on television last night against? Or do you see this as they're prepared to go in to the Senate and say, you know, these New York Times stories say this is what he was doing? How do you understand what they're teeing up here in that regard?
I think you could read it either way. And it's not obvious to me that the brief gives us a clear, you know, push in one direction or another. One way to read it that suggests that they might not be calling witnesses is later on in the brief when the House discusses why it moved to pass articles of impeachment so quickly. It points out that, you know, this was conduct that everybody could see was happening, right? It didn't require a long investigation to get right. And so the argument there is that it doesn't, you know, violate any due process rights on Trump's end. You could also read that in the witness context as saying, we don't need witnesses. Everybody here knows what happened. And also, look, here are some New York Times reports. I do think we see very often there's a tendency with Trump where if he does something in public, everybody is much more willing to brush it off than they are if it turns out he does it in private, right? So if he stands up on a stage in Georgia and says, this election was stolen from me and I want Georgia officials to find me more votes, everyone's sort of, you know, like, oh, well, that's Trump. But if he does it in a private phone call, that suddenly, you know, like, that's the big bombshell. So I do think it's important not to underplay the extent of the evidence against him as it now stands, as set out in the brief, which is, frankly, considering the standards of evidence for impeachment, I would argue pretty overwhelming. That said, I could, you know, look, if I were the House impeachment managers, I could well be reaching out to various people who are around Trump at the time and sort of quietly saying, hey, look, like, if we call you in, will you talk? It's hard for me to see what advantage there is in miring themselves in any kind of drawn out dispute over whether so-and-so will come testify or not, just because it bogs down the trial and sort of procedural questions that lose the sense of urgency and drama. But, you know, if it turns out that Mark Meadows, you know, really wants to unburden himself in front of the Senate, you know, and tell about what he saw as the chief of staff, that could certainly be useful. So I'm not sure.
What do you think, David? Are they setting up here an aggressive call for witnesses, or are they kind of hanging back and saying, "We'll we may do it or we may not, but we're not committing at this point"?
It looks to me like they're preparing for both contingencies here. I mean, at the basic level, they have within this brief a clear step-by-step of all the tweets, of all the public statements, all the stuff that's in plain view, and then the statements, which I found myself circling going through, of reportedly. And those were the press reports about what Trump was doing as this was going on and how happy he was about it and why he couldn't understand why his aides weren't as exhilarated as he was. you can either put that in here and just establish that as part of the record and dare people to challenge it, in which case you can call witnesses, or you can decide for other reasons that calling witnesses is a good strategy and then use that as an excuse to, because otherwise there could be a claim made, well, you didn't have that in your brief. We weren't prepared to talk about that. It would be weak, but there's a lot of weak things on the other side, frankly. So to me, it doesn't necessarily telegraph one move or the other. It shows that they are prepared for both options should they come to pass.
I agree with that, but I also think it is a very weak position for them to be in, to be making arguments for impeachment based on anonymously sourced press reports.
Absolutely. And I believe that's one of the elements in the president's brief that is most interesting, is they pick up on that in a unique way and seem to be preparing to play off of that.
And I think they're clearly not sure about whether they have, the sort of domestic support for, you know, they didn't say certain keywords that I was looking for, like witnesses will testify at trial that, right? Or we will prove at trial that. The brief reads as though it will stand if it has to on the basis of the public record as currently exists. But I have to say, I would be a little bit embarrassed to be Jamie Raskin next week and have to go up and make arguments that this is what happened with no record evidence of it whatsoever, other than an anonymously sourced sequence of New York Times articles. And I think they're actually better lawyers than that. And it seems to me if they're putting this in, that suggests to me that they are going to try to bring the witnesses in to establish it. And I don't fear, along the lines that Quinta does, that, you know, people will just stiff them because they presumably have the votes to compel their attendance, which was not obviously clear last time. And so you could end up with a very dicey situation last time because Democrats didn't really have the votes to enforce a subpoena necessarily. This time they do. And so if I were Mark Meadows or Stephen Miller or whoever was in the room with Donald Trump, I'd be kind of worried about that, as is Lindsey Graham, who went on some network or the other last night and basically started issuing threats about what would happen if they tried to call witnesses.
I understand all that, but I'm still not convinced that every word in this brief has to come up in the speeches to the Senate, because it's in here, and you can make the case for this impeachment without referring at all to the New York Times or Axios.
Agreed.
Or whatever other reporting is in here. I think it can easily be going on the facts of what Trump said publicly, and then if they want to bring that up, it's in the brief, but I don't think they need to bring it up in the trial just because it's in the brief.
I completely agree with David. I think that's absolutely right. You don't need all the sentences that start with reportedly. I think if you did a search and replace and deleted everything there, you would still have a perfectly strong brief because, as everyone listening to this probably knows, the standard of evidence in an impeachment trial is not the standard in a criminal trial. And so we don't need to prove, you know, that Trump was sitting there giggling and gleeful watching the television. I think it's perfectly acceptable to say, look, this guy told people that the election was stolen. He stood there and told them to go to the Capitol, and then he didn't do anything when they went to the Capitol. But the other thing that I would flag, Ben, is that I do think the political dynamics here in terms of what the Democrats want are worth paying attention to. I'm not saying that they would vote against witnesses if it came to that, but they have 2 years essentially to get legislation through before they potentially lose their Senate majority in the midterm elections. That's not that much time. And so I do wonder whether the Democratic caucus may want to not drag this trial out so they can get back to, you know, passing all the great legislation that they so dearly want to pass so they can hold on to their seats, rather than spending this time on sort of a protracted vote over witnesses and then hearing the witnesses and then hearing the arguments. Whereas during the first impeachment trial, there was an incentive on the Democratic side to maybe drag it out a little more so that it was hanging over Trump as he headed into the election. So I don't know that for sure, but I do wonder whether that's a dynamic that may change the calculus here.
I just think if that were the operative dynamic, then you would have written a different brief. And specifically that section where you're making 6 or 8 pages of allegations about the president's behavior not in public, you would have been much more careful about the way you did it if you weren't planning to substantiate it. And I think we will, you know relatively early, because they will presumably have to articulate who they want to hear from. So I think this is one of the big wild cards we're going to have to watch, whether this is going to be a series of performative speeches like we got last time, or whether there is going to be an actual element of trial here, which is something we did not see last time. And by the way, we did not see, for those audience members who are old enough to remember the Clinton impeachment trial, we did not see then either. All right, let's turn to the president's brief, which is a shorter and a more puzzling document, I suppose. Quinta, what does it say to you about what the basic case that the president's, former president's, new lawyers mean to put on?
Honestly, most of what it says to me is that Trump got rid of his legal team that was supposed to be handling this over the weekend, and then his new legal team came in and they only had 2 days to put this together. It's such a weird document. It's pretty opaque to me what the strategy is, if there is one. It is interesting to me the way that it describes Trump in manner that is presumably picked to avoid offending him, as we discussed, the, you know, the 45th president rather than the former president. There's one point where it says, since the 45th president is no longer, and then quotes, president. There are things like that. There are things where it sort of says, you know, okay, we're not saying that Trump's claims of election fraud are true. We're just saying that there's not enough evidence to say whether they're not true. So he denies that they're false. So, it, I mean, to me, at least, it reads like something that was put together very quickly and with a desire to avoid pissing Trump off. And as we all know, Trump has not exactly been a model client for his various sets of lawyers over the last 4 years. So I would expect that what we'll see is one more variation on the sort of odd spectacle of lawyers trying to keep a client happy when the client is sort of incapable of understanding what's in his best interests. If I were them, I would focus the whole time on the jurisdictional question of whether or not a former official can be impeached. They don't spend that much time on it. They do get into it, but there's a great deal of, you know, denying that Trump did anything wrong, denying that he incited anything, denying that his allegations of election fraud were provably false. And so at the end of it, I sort of read through this hodgepodge and say, you know, look, it's clearly written by someone who's working for Trump. Beyond that, I have absolutely nothing.
What do you think, David? Can you discern from this document any likely strategy?
I'm with Quinta on almost every point here. The strategy is deny, deny, deny on every front. Just put up a wall, and in fact, put up some walls that don't need to be put up, that raise some questions about just exactly how much the president himself was involved in the drafting of this. So Quinta's right. The jurisdictional issue is probably one the defense wants to emphasize, because you've already had senators bring that up as a valid issue for them. They think that you can't try this impeachment at all, and you certainly can't convict the president because the president does not hold office anymore. So they make that case, and then they often repeat it at the end of the paragraphs rebutting other claims. So they keep putting it out there, but they don't spend a lot of time going through it, as opposed to the dozens upon dozens of pages in the House brief. The president's brief simply assert that the president does not hold office, So this current proceeding is void. The parts that look to me like Donald Trump himself had a role in it are the fifth point, where they address the claim that President Trump said, "We won this election and we won it by a landslide." They admit that he addressed the crowd and they admit that he used words like that. But then they say, to the extent that this claim alleges his opinion is in error, the 45th president denies this allegation. Basically, he forced them to put in here something that reporting suggests the first team of lawyers quit over, which is putting in the claim that, in fact, he won the election and he won it by a landslide. One of the walls that they put up that I was a bit surprised to see, and I think it appears twice in the document, they emphasize, going back to what you said, Ben, about the oath, they go back and say Donald Trump fully and faithfully executed his duties and at all times acted to the best of his ability to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Later on, they use similar language, not the exact language of the oath, but they say, as a rebuttal to a point, a blanket assertion that the 45th president of the United States performed admirably in his role as president, at all times doing what he thought was in the best interests of the American people. And both of those are just put out there as if those are blanket defenses against the charges and the details of the incitement and other ideas here. And the logic is just bizarre to me that they would put that up as a claim, because I had to use the analogy with my son of why that was weird. Can you imagine running a red light, being pulled over, police officer asks you what happened? You say, "Well, you know, I ran the red light, but I thought that was in the best interests of the people." It's irrelevant what you think is in the best interests of the people. They're not even arguing against the facts at that point. They're just making a blanket assertion. Things like that make me think Trump was more involved in this than perhaps in the claims that his defense made in the first impeachment trial. I think that legal brief, if I remember right, that trial brief was something like 110 pages. This one is 13 and a half, and it doesn't even address the bulk of the factual record as presented in the House manager's brief.
So again, I'm just trying to imagine how this translates into a presentation next week. And I can see building a presentation around the what's effectively the conclusion on page 14, where they write, "Wherefore, Donald John Trump, 45th President of the United States, respectfully requests the honorable members of the Senate to dismiss Article 1 because the Senate lacks jurisdiction to remove from office a man who does not hold office. In the alternative, the 45th president respectfully requests the Senate acquit him on the merits of the allegations raised in the article of impeachment." That seems to me to be the closest thing that there is, that they're fundamental to, you know, to an articulation of their what will be their actual position next week, which is, you know, point one, you don't have jurisdiction over this because he's not the president anymore. Point two, if you do have jurisdiction over it, he behaved just fine. Is that kind of what you guys are expecting, or do you think it'll be more elaborate than that?
That sounds about right to me. I mean, if you remember, in the first impeachment trial, there was kind of a split screen between the two different teams that Trump had, because he had both the team that was counsel to the president and then another team that was the Office of White House Counsel. And so the first group, I think the most notable member of whom was Jay Sekulow, sort of got up there and kind of waved his arms around and did a bunch of bits that will look good on Fox News when they're chopped up into 30-minute segments. And it didn't really make very much sense if you were listening for legal argumentation. And then the second group from the White House counsel's office, so Patrick Cipollone, Patrick Philbin, went up there and made a lot of, you know, sort of dense legal argumentation. We can debate which of those displays was more embarrassing to the legal profession, but I think we might see that split here in this second trial as well, just not coming from two different teams, because there isn't the kind of division between Trump the person and Trump the resident of the office of the presidency. So instead, you're going to see maybe one team of lawyers trying to produce both those things, the first, the sort of Fox News fodder to make their client happy, and the second, to actually make the argument that they need to make in order to get him acquitted.
But of course, the more generous version of that point would be that they have a legal argument and a factual argument, right? The legal argument is that you don't have jurisdiction over this. The factual argument is that the facts aren't nearly as bad as Jamie Raskin thinks they are. And, you know, we're prepared to show or at least argue that the president behaved reasonably. My question is like, okay, well, does that mean they're going to put on evidence? Does that mean he's going to testify in his own defense, which seems to me unthinkable? So, like, to the extent that they are going to rely on claims of fact, how do they mean to present those?
Well, I got to say, I'm with Quinta on, and I hadn't really thought about that before she brought it up, about the issue that having almost two separate teams before and now, you know, this duo that's going to tackle absolutely everything from matters of fact to matters of interpretation to matters of jurisdiction. I think you're right. The jurisdictional issue as the legal issue is clearly the way to go, at least as a first step. But I'm not so convinced that their backup claim is as strong. That is claiming, yeah, the president did some of these things, but it wasn't as bad as you think, because you simply haven't had that many people using that argument as the jurisdictional argument. So I'm not convinced that that's necessarily where they're going to go. They could try to nitpick. That is, the defense could try to say, well, you make claims, as you mentioned, Ben, about the president's mood, prove it. Or they could nitpick, as they do in this brief itself, in some of the few areas where they get into substance, they could nitpick and say, oh, come on, those words don't mean what you think. When he said he was going to wanted Georgia to find votes, he merely meant that he thought that there had been, you know, some, they don't use this word, but they paraphrase their language. He was merely pointing out that the truth is out there and he wanted them to find it, not that he wanted them to manufacture it. And so I think this brief points to the fact that they're going to just try to create, for lack of a better term, reasonable doubt, although I think in the Senate, it's more like any fig leaf they can grab, to undermine one or more elements here. And then they build the case why that should discount the impeachment. They do it on page 12 when they argue that by charging multiple alleged wrongs in one article, the House of Representatives has made it impossible to guarantee compliance with the constitutional mandate. They say that this means it's impossible to know if two-thirds of the members actually agree on the entire article or just on parts as the basis for a vote to convict. It's a weird argument, but it's one that if they can try to pick nits here and there, then they make the claim, even if you agree there's jurisdiction here, and even if you agree with 99 out of 100 things that are alleged in the article of impeachment, if you disagree on one, you can't convict because there's only one article and you have to agree with all of it.
We're going to leave it there. David Preece, Quinta Jurecic, thanks for joining us this evening. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our social media manager for the Lawfare Podcast is you, the listener. So get out there and tweet about us, share us on Facebook, pin us on Pinterest, make TikTok videos about us if you've downloaded TikTok, which I most sincerely hope you haven't done. Our music is, of course, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.